And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional, state news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists and, in this case, filmmakers. We're joined by Billy Corbin, who is a part of Raconteur Films, a documentary filmmaker who grew up right here in South Florida. Mr. Corbin, good to see you again.
I also do butt injections in room 203 of the Biscayne Inn Motel.
Okay, we don't. Later on, maybe on that. Glenn Garvin is also with us. He is with the Miami Herald, and he is a longtime television writer and has written just about everything there is to write about TV and Latin America, Central America. He's traveled the world. Glenn, it's always good to have you on this panel as well.
You'll note I wore a tuxedo today.
Yes, you did. Buttoned up. The best dressed of the bunch, no doubt, is our newcomer, who I probably should have introduced first because it's just manners. But it's nice to welcome aboard a lovely young lady named Paula Uyuspa Abbott. Now, I got that right. She's with the Daily Business Review, and we heard her on Marketplace a few weeks ago, and we invited her along for Florida Roundup. Welcome to the show, Paula.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It is, by the way, this show is an exercise in civic engagement. I think we've figured that out over the last 4 years that we've been doing it. So we're trying to bring everybody into the process of how things get done, laws and how they get made. And this is your chance to have your say, because we have this, what we call this town hall meeting, this very important engagement in democracy that is taking place on Monday, February 25th at 6:30 p.m. at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. It is on the upcoming state legislative session. A lot of laws get made in Tallahassee that impact us here in South Florida. So if you want to get your voice heard, tell some state lawmakers. We've got Senator Chris Smith, Senator Jack Latvala. We're working on some other lawmakers. We've got Mary Ellen Kloss from the Miami Herald. And we've got a whole bunch of stuff planned. You want to get your voice heard in Tallahassee? Show up. Okay, go to WLRN.org, register right there. Again, it's Monday, February 25th, 6:30 p.m. at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts, and we'll remind you again about that. So let's begin on the Dolphins stadium issue, which is related to Tallahassee. Plans by the Dolphins to secure state sales tax revenue and tourist taxes for their $400 million renovation of Sun Life Stadium have jumped through their first hoops. The Florida Senate Commerce and Tourism Committee unanimously passed the measure. It would allow the Dolphins to receive a $3 million a year sales tax break. It would also pave the way for millions more through a 1 cent increase in Miami-Dade's local tourist development tax or hotel tax everywhere except for Miami Beach. Now, here is the bill sponsored by Democratic Senator Oscar Brannon of Miami Gardens. He says the Dolphins employ a lot of people.
We want to make sure they stay that way. We want to make sure that, the Marlins leaving left a gaping hole in part-time jobs, full-time jobs. And, you know, we want to make sure that we're able to keep the ones that we have there.
But the Dolphin Stadium bill took a big hit in Tallahassee this week among its own delegation. It was not among the goals of the Miami-Dade delegation, more like a Jackson Memorial Hospital, a memorial for the Bay of Pigs veterans, insurance price hikes. Paula, you start us off here. How far can this go in Tallahassee? What do you think the chances are of this actually passing the state?
Very simple. If it is a controversial issue, most likely is going to die in the Senate. You know, they have a tendency to postpone issues that are controversial to the last day, and of course they always run out of time. So now it seems like there is support in our community for this project. So if that is the case, even though I have to tell you, I'm very impressed that the Miami-Dade delegation did not make it a priority, because the priorities that they chose are really priorities in our county. So I'm glad that wasn't part, but I have to tell you, most of our community here supports, you know, boosting, using our money, you know, taxpayers' money, to go ahead and boost the stadium.
And these are hotel taxes, but there are still
sales tax too.
Sales tax
that we all pay.
Revenue from Tallahassee, but still obviously the bitter taste in everybody's mouths with the Marlins stadium, Billy Corbin, and this is not going to be an easy sell.
Well, I think it's funny that we're surprised that the Dade delegation would actually prioritize things that are priorities for their constituents, but Representative Jose Felix Diaz said it, that these are the things that are actually important to our constituents, the issue of health care and education and these issues that all matter. But I think the really incredible point is that as you listen to the remarks from Miami-Dade County commissioners and read the remarks from Florida state senators, it seems that after all these years and all these public financing deals on private sports venues, they still don't actually have a real handle on what these deals are all about or how they work. And that's pretty disconcerting to me, reading some of the remarks from the people who are supposed to represent the taxpayers' best interest in this matter. And as we know, any politician who supported the Marlins Park deal was either duped or bought, and either way, they can't be trusted.
Now, the business community is sort of lining up. And as Paula said, there's been some support from the business community. In fact, this week, the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce has endorsed the increase in hotel taxes. They gave the thumbs up. Says it will be good for the county's economy. And I spoke with another business leader this week, actually recently, not this week, but Frank Nero, who is with the president of Miami's Beacon Council, which is Miami-Dade's official economic development partner. And here's what he told me.
There's obvious benefits, both short-term and long-term, by having, you know, this kind of improvements in our infrastructure. And I look at a stadium as infrastructure like I would a performing arts center or if I would, you know, the port. It all is what makes part of a community. But there are some clear issues that are going to have to be addressed and resolved to the satisfaction of the mayor, of the commission, and I think as a population at large who I think has a very skeptical and jaundiced look at this.
So, Glenn Garvin, what do you think of that statement?
Well, it's hardly surprising that the business community supports this. Businessmen always support handouts to business. Every guy in the Chamber of Commerce thinks that his company is going to be the next to get a truckload of taxpayer money dumped on him. That doesn't mean it's a good idea. I don't care what the business community thinks. And though I hate to pick on the new girl, Paula, I could not disagree
she could defend
with
herself.
You. I could not disagree with you more strongly. There is very little support for this in the community, and that is precisely why the Dolphins and the politicians have conspired on a timetable that will prevent this from being put to a public vote. It would lose. They know it. They know it. They will, you know, do cartwheels naked down Flagler to avoid putting this to a referendum because it'll lose.
But Paula, you did mention this when we were preparing for the show, that the Dolphins are going for this. They're a cultural institution, too. We've seen other publicly funded, the Arts Center, for instance, of Miami-Dade County. That's cultural institution. Dolphins say, well, they're a cultural institution, too, and they deserve the same type of assistance.
Psychologically, in our minds, this deal is very different from the Marlins Stadium. And part of it has to do, and maybe in my view, because I'm a real estate reporter, the owner of the team is Stephen Ross. And he has done a lot of things in our community in partnership with George Perez, their related group. They have built condos that had brought a lot of foreign investment to our community. You know, most of the condos that they build are bought by Latin Americans and some Europeans. So they're helping our community in an economic way that no other developer, I would say, have done. So I think because of that, and trust me, I'm not a big fan of developers. I mean, I've been very critical of George Perez, and I can tell you they don't take criticism very well. But they have helped our community by bringing foreign capital, and I think that's going to give them some points in their favor.
This deal is the same as the Marlins. It's just for less money. I disagree. This is sports welfare, plain and simple. In 2010, a Harvard study showed that 87% of the operating costs of NFL venues alone in this country are paid for by taxpayers. Since 1992, U.S. tax dollars, $18.6 billion in U.S. tax dollars, have gone towards NFL stadiums. In that same time period, NFL owners have invested only $6 billion. The NFL is a multi-billion dollar business. They have $9 billion in revenue every year, but they're still categorized as a not-for-profit organization, which denies the federal government $91 million in tax revenue every year. But here we are continuing to write checks to billionaire team owners to enhance the value of their private business.
And what you hear, though, we'll put the comma there, but what you hear a lot is from sports fans, people that sort of know this stuff, and me included, you, that this is sort of, you know, corporate welfare, that these teams could afford it. Now they're putting out this trial balloon, trying to get as much money as possible from the public before the NFL steps in, which has tons of money, as Billy said, steps in and gives their own contribution. So it's a negotiation right now, isn't it?
Billy, you can give us all the numbers, all the statistics that you want in the world, but at the end of the day, this is an emotional decision that the community is going to make. And if the community feel like that they love the stadium and they love the Dolphins, then, you know, who cares? about the rest.
I'm sorry. Do I reject that. The community may love Jennifer Lopez, too. That doesn't mean we should give her $1 billion in tax money to show our appreciation for her lower part.
Says who?
okay.
Well, let's have a referendum on it. If the deal is really better than the Marlins, then let's vote on it.
I agree 100%
right.
with you.
Let's reset things and remind people they are listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Our guests on this hour is Billy Corbin from Raconteur Films, documentary filmmaker, Paula Luspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review, and Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald. It's already been a lively time, and I'm sure we'll probably get some feedback through Twitter. Please follow us at WLRN. You can follow me at Phil Latzman. Billy is Twittering right now at Billy Corbin. And everybody knows you're the Twitter star, Glenn Garvin. And Paula, you are, tell us your Twitter handle.
P.I.U.S.P.A. at P.I.U.S.P.A.
All right. So we're going to continue the discussion online and on the radio. We'll take an early break here. When we come back, we'll get into some politics as we get ready for the State of the Union address on Tuesday night. Well, you want to take a call, too? All right, fine. Let's do that. Let's since we're on this topic, why stop now? Let's go to Tommy, who is in waiting in Coconut Grove. Tommy, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Well, thank you. First of all, I just want to make a quick comment on Corbin. He's a very funny guy and a great filmmaker. But I live in Miami. I'm a Dolphins fan, but I'm definitely against the stadium. I see it as corporate welfare myself. And my question, I do have a specific question. Number one, I resent the fact that we're able to quickly jump and raise a penny for a sports team and not able to do that for our school systems or anything else like that are in desperate need. I mean, Dade County Public Schools, they haven't fixed the building or repaired some buildings in 20 years. And I resent that we're so quick to do that. But let's say that, like the Marlins Stadium, and this gets shoved down our throats, like I expect it will, like a lot of things happen. What happens to that penny sales tax after the stadium is paid off? I mean, does it just go into the coffers of the state? Does it roll back? Can it say, hey, after the stadium is paid off, that penny sales tax is going to go as
it's going to be a long time.
It goes to the Daily Business Review, right, Bill?
No, stop it. I mean, once it goes, they'll reappropriate it, I'm sure, for something else. But we're talking about 30 years from now, right, or a few decades ahead. Tommy, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it. Now, maybe on the other side, or actually, Javi is in Miami, and I think he probably agrees. Javi, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hi there.
So
go
ahead.
I just have two comments. The first going with the last speaker said that I think it's irresponsible that we would be spending money on a sports team and not on teachers and on infrastructure and on police. I mean, it just seems wholly irresponsible. Yeah. And my second comment is if there is so much support, going back to this referendum, if there's so much support for it, why are they afraid to put it to a vote?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I agree. That should be the responsible thing to do.
All right. Javi, thanks very much. voting always seems to sort those things out. It'd be interesting to see if that's something that could even get to a referendum.
But hopefully not one of those American Airlines arena yes means no and no means yes.
In the middle of August, right. In the middle of August.
And you know what? The owner of the team, they should pay for the referendum because it's going to cost money to the
county.
Absolutely.
And it's solely for their benefit. Absolutely.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup, a lively discussion already with Billy Corbin from Raconteur Films, Paula Luspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review, Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald, and we'll come back and switch gears a bit to politics and immigration reform, possibly a little bit talking about the governor's budget reaction, some state stuff, and some foreclosures. We got a lot of stuff to talk about, so we'll take a break and come back and do it in just a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, and it's good to have you along. Let's move on to some politics, and we also want to remind you, please, please, please RSVP to our – honestly, we'd love to – this is the kind of event we really want to see people come out to. We know we have a lot of listeners to this show, so if listeners to this show could get on there and RSVP to our town hall, show up there, ask these lawmakers questions on February 25th, that would be fantastic. So, again, that's our town hall meeting on the state legislative session. February 25th, Monday, 6:30 p.m. at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. Make Tallahassee accountable and get online at WLRN.org.
You'll have a better turnout if you add cockfights.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe if it's somewhere else, but it's in Fort Lauderdale. So let's move on to talking about politics. And Florida's freshman senator from Miami, Marco Rubio, will give the Republican rebuttal to President Barack Obama's State of the Union address on Tuesday night. The GOP's choice of Rubio by House Speaker John Boehner and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell tells us some things about the direction of the party. He's already been on now this week the cover of Time magazine, authored by our friend Michael Grunwald, who lives here in Miami. He'll speak, Senator Rubio, after Mr. Obama's, we don't call him Mr. Obama anymore, we just call him Obama's primetime address before Congress. NPR changed their rule on that, by the way. Anyway, both in English and in Spanish, offering a counterpoint to the president's agenda. Paula, why do you think Marco Rubio was chosen, and what does it mean for his status?
Well, I think it's brilliant. I mean, if they want to reach the Hispanic community, you know, obviously you're going to pick a Hispanic guy. Now, you know, I'm Hispanic myself, and I listen to TV in Spanish and English. I'm not only bilingual, but I'm also bicultural. And I can tell you that it doesn't matter if you speak Spanish if you don't send the right message. He has to say in Spanish what people Hispanic want to hear. Otherwise, he can pray in Spanish, he can sing in Spanish, he can do whatever he wants to do in Spanish, but if he doesn't send the right message, you know, it's going to be a waste of time.
Glenn Garvin, what do you think this says about the status of Senator Marco Rubio?
Well, he's a bright guy, and I think the Republicans can and have do much worse than him. I do think there's some delusion involved in this. Hispanics, we talk about Hispanics and the Hispanic community. There is no monolithic Hispanic community. Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans in New York and Cubans in Miami, very different groups with very different political ideas, and there is no one guy who speaks to that. Rubio's politics are not really gonna play that well, I don't think, with Mexican Americans in Southern California. They see the world very differently than he does. I'm not saying one is better than the other, but they're different. This idea that just by putting a guy named Rubio up there, Republicans are going to make giant inroads into the Hispanic vote, I think is not going to play out.
Senator Rubio, as we mentioned, appears on the cover of Time magazine. I think for the coming week, it'll be on the newsstands. The cover has already been out there. What's interesting is it's different in, if you're the international edition, say something different, as like the Republicans' New Hope or the U.S. Republicans' New Hope. But on the cover of the U.S. edition of Time magazine is the picture of Senator Rubio and calling him the Republican Savior. And on Twitter yesterday, in response, he said, quote, "There is only one savior, and that is not me." And then he hashtagged Jesus. So that was a very good response. I mean, you know the guy's got it. We know a little bit about it. He's got a great sense of humor. He's smart. He's, you know, it takes him about 20 seconds to say the things that Bill Nelson says in like 2 minutes. For those that have digested senators for a long time. But I mean, you have to agree that they really think that Marco Rubio is going to be the star of the future in the Republicans. Now we're beginning to hear this rivalry between Rubio and Jeb Bush, as Jeb Bush kind of came out a little bit critical of immigration reforms. Now, this is something, Glenn, that Jeb Bush has been talking about for years, immigration reform, and that the Republican Party has been tone deaf on. You see sort of a division there and possibly setting up a possible rivalry between Jeb and Marco in 2016?
Maybe, although I know everybody says Jeb Bush is getting ready to run, and certainly you can point to some evidence for that. I honestly think, though, that it's just difficult for me to see another Bush getting elected president. There's Bush exhaustion. Even if you liked the Bush number one and Bush number two, at some point, you know, maybe enough guys from the same family have been president. I don't see this.
All right, and one final thing, Billy. What would you like to hear as a South Floridian in the State of the Union address on Tuesday night, which we'll carry here on WLRN? What would you like to hear from President Obama?
as a South Floridian, I'd like to hear that he's going to fix our sewage problem. $1.5 billion. You want to know something that's going to scare tourists off from this town faster than anything else?
It's bubbling sewage.
It's a sewage catastrophe that by all accounts could occur at any moment here.
And I agree, we're going to need a lot of federal funding for that.
For infrastructure, very, very interesting. We want to remind you, by the way, this is your show, too. By the way, I thought this week the discussion about the penny being abolished, they should melt down every penny and build pipes, right? Well, wouldn't that make sense?
Not a bad idea, but in all seriousness, I think the Everglades. What happened to the Everglades? Isn't this something we're capable of doing great things in this country? Save the Everglades?
Well, there's news on that in just a moment. The budget actually is out for the state and includes a lot more money for Everglades projects. I want to remind you that you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. We're way behind on our topics, but that's okay because we're having fun. We have Paola Liuspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review, also with us Billy Corbin from Raconteur Films, and Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald, and your questions are welcome. We have a live blog actually going on Twitter. It's being hosted by our good friend, social media editor Danny Rivero. You can also find the discussion. We have a Facebook page, the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We also have it on our website, WLRN.org, which is so much better than it used to be. There's all kinds of great stuff on there now that we provide you with information on. Now, let's move on to the next stage of the show, into the governor's budget. A nonprofit group that advocates for state budget and pension reforms is highly critical of what it calls Governor Scott's spending spree. His proposed budget of $74.2 billion, the largest in state history. President Bob Williams of the Virginia-based State Budget Solutions calls the spending plan reckless and dangerous to Florida's economy.
They have a $3.7 billion unfunded liability for retiree health care, and they have almost $100 billion unfunded liability for pensions. And so rather than creating new programs or expanding programs, we think they should be prudent and set aside a reserve, look at doing things more efficiently, and start paying off some of these debts.
So is this budget too robust now that we had a governor that was talking about saving money, and now are we spending too much money? Glenn, what do you think?
I think this budget has everything to do with Rick Scott's re-election. He's decided to become a Democrat.
Just 2 years?
Politician. He got in a lot of trouble in his first term, and he's decided the way to fix it is to hand out goodies to everybody, starting with state employees who are as anti-Republican a constituency as you can possibly imagine. I think this is absurd. It has nothing to do with real needs. It certainly has nothing to do with budget responsibility. It has to do with Rick Scott getting reelected.
Lawmakers in Tallahassee, as we get set for this session, vowing more scrutiny of economic incentive money, tax cuts, incentives, all these things. There's a report by Integrity Florida, which has partnered with us on a few projects, and Americans for Prosperity. Some leadership expressing concerns about, you know, how money is spent, but we hear this every year. Is this the year that we do truly make Tallahassee accountable for these types of things? Or no, I guess not.
Is anybody here holding their breath over this?
Okay. Well, we're going to try at our town hall meeting on February 25th. Let me tell you right there. So you better RSVP. The other stuff that we want to talk about, this is a very important issue for the state. We just heard, Paola, that newly released figures showing that Florida's foreclosure problem continues to get worse in 2012. And as we see the residual effects of what's gone on, this is still a major issue for Florida and South Florida.
It is. It is, especially for homeowners, district homeowners in Dade County. Right now, the county, the Miami-Dade Circuit Court, has implemented a program to speed up foreclosures. And, you know, when you talk to foreclosure defense lawyers, they're saying that they're going so fast that they're not really respecting homeowners' right to due process. And in part, it has to do because, and I experienced it in person, you talk to some judges and they say, well, you know, after all, these people are living in their houses for free. Like saying, well, you know, forget about their due process. So, you know, my response to them is like, if you find somebody with a smoking gun in their hand, you know, say to send them to jail, forget about due process. So, you know, that is where, you know, homeowners may be in the losing end at this time.
I've witnessed this firsthand.
I'd like to ask Paula a question here.
Go ahead.
What is we're talking about speeding up this process and there's not enough time. What is the average length of time it takes to foreclose on a property in Florida?
It's about 2.5 years, I would say.
Okay, so we're going to cut some months off this, and that's going to deprive everybody of due process.
I find it hard to believe.
Okay, so why is somebody has to be in the losing end? Why is the homeowner and not the lender? You know, one of the problems is that a lot of the paperwork that has been filed is not proper. So many judges are turning a blind eye to those documents.
The lender is already on the short end of this. For 2.5 years, he's not being paid on his loan. All we're talking about is shortening that 2.5 years to something
All we're
more
talking
reasonable.
About is due process. I mean, we're not in a developing country where you cannot trust the court system.
Due process, actually, these insanely lengthy legal processes are precisely characteristic of
but
a
the
little
reason,
banana
Glenn,
republic countries.
Isn't the reason that these foreclosures are coming so quickly, but they're turning back on the tap after the robo-signing scandal, so it's just natural that we're...
I thought that was highly overblown. I'm sure we can find, occasional examples of people who were done wrong in this. The fact is that everything is weighted on the homeowner's side right now, and all they're talking about doing is evening that up a little bit. Seriously, you stop paying on your loan for 2.5 years?
Well, you know why it was 2.5 years? Because the banks were not pushing forward the cases. They would file a foreclosure lawsuit and sit in there. You know, the case wouldn't move. And it was the responsibility to push the case forward, either to trial or to do a summary judgment. If they were not doing it, then the homeowner was living for free for 2-3 years.
And
but not because the homeowner asked for it.
And it was because the lenders didn't want to take on the obligation of the maintenance or what have you. And I witnessed the rocket docket in Lee County firsthand several years ago. I haven't seen what it looks like here, but there's a line of lawyers out the window. You have a jury box filled with representatives for the banks. They come up and do multiple cases. Sometimes the defendants are in the courtroom, but they don't even hear their name called. They don't even understand the language, and there is no due process. You just see the judge bang his gavel, and it's one after the other. It's really fast food justice.
All right, now that leads us to what I think is going to be the subject of the Raconteur Films next documentary.
Uh-oh.
And that has
not
been
the
story of the week. No, not the stadium. Squatters. Mm. Because that is, this week we heard about the Boca squatter known as Loki Boy. Has been kicked out and evicted from his Boca Raton mansion. Bank of America took repossession of that $2.5 million home.
I like that you refer to it as his Boca Raton mansion.
Well, no, that's right. I think I did not. You're right. Possession of the home. The 23-year-old Brazilian national named Andre Barbosa had been staying there since December. We also read about a family that may have squatted in a $1 million home in Coral Gables. This might be going on all over South Florida. We just don't know about it. I say Raconteur Films, get the crew down there, live with these squatters for a while, stay there until they get kicked out. Best documentary film ever.
I think it's a reality show. I think we just move in with the squatters, and it's like the Real Housewives of Squatter County, and we just go all over South Florida, and we move in. We just move in. There's no location fees. It's terrific.
I think it's a fascinating story.
I love it.
I don't see how Raconteur can do this unless you can show evidence it was going on in 1978.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup. Are you calling Billy anachronistic? Is that what you're saying?
I do historical documentaries, much like Miami Herald does historical news. It's yesterday's news, tomorrow, corrections to follow.
All right. And moving on, and we're going to talk about some other stuff, but I wanted to get into the FPL stuff because that was a real big subject for me this week. FPL, I think, probably wants me to disappear. But
they're busy at the Superdome.
Yeah, right. Well, don't go there. There are lawyers listening. Don't know. Anyway, the state's consumer advocate is appealing a base rate increase totaling $350 million for Florida Power and Light that could add $10 a month to your average bill over the next 4 years. Public counsel J.R. Kelly filed a notice yesterday that he'll appeal to the High Court of Florida. He's challenging the PSC's approval of a settlement between the utility and groups representing commercial and federal government customers. He says it's a bad deal for most of Florida Power and Light's 4.6 million customers. Now, I happened to talk with FPL's president this week, Eric Szilagyi, and I asked him the question that apparently I wasn't supposed to, but on many people's mind, about the Public Service Commission again approving rate hikes.
They have not said no. The public kind of feels like the PSC might be in FPL's back pocket.
You know, that's just not true. You look at the Public Service Commission, I think, frankly, that's a disservice to the professional staff that are up there and the commissioners. We go through multiple days of hearings under oath, under sworn testimony, providing expert witnesses to this. And here's the bottom line for customers and if you will, the critics to think about. There are 55 electric providers in the state of Florida.
FPL provides the lowest bill in the state by far.
All right, so you made his point there, and you heard the full interview on WLRN and during Morning Edition, and they're arguing, Paula, that the nuclear cost recovery fee Turkey Point is says add 10,000 jobs and injected hundreds of millions of dollars to South Florida's economy, but a lot of people in Tallahassee want to see this nuclear recovery fee removed from the bill, and FPL is fighting against it.
Yeah, I wonder if he has a plan in mind to help people pay their bills when they can no longer afford them. Maybe he has a subsidy plan in mind.
Right.
Because, I mean, if they keep increasing our utility bills, you know, our salary doesn't increase at the same pace.
Right. So they're getting the $350 million increase, which...
And they're going to pass that to us.
Right. And then they're also getting the... they're continuing to get the nuclear cost recovery fee, which is collecting money. I think it's collected about $320 million so far. And the Public Service Commission, Glenn, I don't know if you follow these things, and I was trying to do some research this morning. I don't remember the last time the Public Service Commission said no to FPL.
The first thing I want to say is that I don't pretend to understand the line items and these costs. And I think, frankly, a lot of reporters don't, and that's part of the problem with the coverage. But I will certainly say it wouldn't surprise me if a government-created monopoly is overcharging its customers. That's what they do. That's what they do.
You get what you get. You're in with FPL. You're in with FPL. I want to talk about rising sea levels. It's something that Paul has done a lot of reporting on, and something I also spoke to FPL's president about this week that raised some hackles in South Florida. So we'll do that in just a moment. We'll take a break. You're listening to the Florida Roundup. I'm Phil Latzman. Our panel this week, Paula Uspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review, Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald, and Billy Corbin from Rockendor Films. And we're back in just a moment. Hi, welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Hey, you, make Tallahassee accountable. We're going to say everybody at once. Ready? Make Tallahassee. You guys are not going to do this with me?
Because I've got to do it. It's my new ringtone.
We're trying to get people to come to this town hall meeting February 25th at the Broward Center. It's a civic engagement. It's democracy in action. And we're trying to fill the place up, show that we can do this. So go to WLRN.org and RSVP for our town hall meeting on making Tallahassee accountable. Or Billy Carbon will make a film about you being apathetic.
Squatting.
Squatting, exactly. All right. Now, also while here last week, this week rather, I asked FPL's president about sea level rise and whether they are prepared at Turkey Point, and his response was this.
You know, we have engineered and designed these facilities with the idea of them operating for many, many decades. Turkey Point and St. Lucie, for that matter, are significantly higher than the other areas around them from a sea level perspective. Remember, Turkey Point had a direct hit on Hurricane Andrew. And that was the highest storm surge recorded that I'm aware of in South Florida.
Now, that got some people upset that Turkey Point did not exactly bear the brunt of Andrew. It may have borne the eye, but the dirty side of the storm was on the north. Anyway, we heard from a lot of people on that, and we plan to fact-check that and do some follow-ups in the coming weeks. But, Paula, to the greater story of sea level rise, which we have been reporting on and focusing on here for a while, in the Daily Business Review, you wrote, quote, "Little by little, South Florida's elected officials are waking up to the reality that the rising sea has become a critical issue with short and long-term impacts." So what is beginning to change?
Yeah, you know, I would say that this is one of the biggest financial challenges that, Florida, especially South Florida, faces. We are surrounded by water. But what has started to change is consciousness. Elected officials are becoming more aware that this is an issue. And they have the four counties from Palm Beach County to Monroe, they have signed a compact agreement. And they're coming with like an action plan of what needs to be done in terms of reinforcing the infrastructure, relocating infrastructure, but also coming up with new zoning laws. So in case there is a storm and they have to rebuild a section of the county, that the reconstruction would be under a different, more strict zoning code. What is also interesting is that, for example, the city of Miami Beach, forever it has been having floodings in the west side of the beach. Mm-hmm. That is not new, but what is new is that the flooding is happening more often, and it happens in sunny days, because what is happening is it's water from the bay is coming in up to the roads, to the streets, through the drainage system. And that is you know, in part is because of the sea level rise. So the city has recently approved a new drainage system, stormwater system, that is going to cost them $200 million to be implemented in 20 years. So who is paying for that? You know, taxpayers are going to be paying for that. So this is a reality that needs elected officials to be proactive, because if we have to make the changes all at once, it's going to cost us a lot of money. In November, same thing happened in Sunrise, A1A, north of Sunrise in Fort Lauderdale. The city, it was a combination of high rise and storm surge. The water swallowed the beach, destroyed the wall that separated the street from the scene, destroyed the sidewalks and part of the road. Now the FDOT and the county and the city of Fort Lauderdale are fixing it, and it's costing them about $8 million. So, you know, it's important that we take action in terms of reinforcing our infrastructure.
And it's not just the doing the little things like the beach renourishment, because that it's like, you know, after a while, it just drops in a bucket, right? I mean, you have to...
Well, you know, actually, the beach renourishment is important if you're going to be building dunes, because that is going to help prevent the flood from reaching the streets and destroying, you know, the roads. So that is very important. And you know, the problem is that elected officials are doing something about it, but you don't have the complete support that you need. And the reason is because now we have a lot of the cities and counties are term, the elected officials are term limited. So who wants to waste any time? And I say waste because that's probably the way they perceive it. You know, planning on something that is going to, you know.
So far in the future.
So far in the future.
Glenn, do you think that? I mean, how do you see this being a pressing issue? I see you're a naysayer on stuff
well,
like this.
I have no idea if the sea level is rising. If Paola has reported this and found that it is, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that. But I don't think this is a reason to pitch out term limits. I don't see any evidence. Politicians never think of anything but passing out swag and their next reelection. That's what they do. That's true whether they're term limited or not. There's no evidence that term limits have cut down on.
But it is an incremental story. Planning. It's an incremental story that you can't cover. But like, Billy, you could take a camera and mount it on top of a building and do a 20-year time lapse photography or something. But that, you know, that takes some planning in advance. But this is not a story until recently that we really saw. And now we see it a little bit more, no?
I have absolutely no problems with FPNL. Then, in the interest of full disclosure, I've been a shareholder for over 20 years. And it's been a lot more profitable than my McClatchy stock.
Well, what about you're living on Miami Beach in the middle, where your power lines could, you know, be pretty wet?
I don't. I fortunately live on the mainland.
Oh, you live on the mainland.
Which is good for me because the city of Miami Beach is crumbling into the Atlantic under the weight of its own corruption.
Oh, that's another story altogether. All right. We also wanted to move on to, speaking of corruption, well, some questionable doings at Citizens Property Insurance, which has been under fire recently for hiking prices and reducing coverage while spending lavish sums on executive travel and handing out generous severance packages to employees accused of misconduct. Yesterday, we had a very successful town hall chat from our producer, Elaine Chen, who engineered the whole thing on Citizens Property Insurance and with Tulu Olorunipo, who does the reporting out of Tallahassee on this very well. Citizens spokeswoman Christine Ashburn says the media has not been treating the company very fairly.
You know, we're a government entity, and we are a large, we write 1.4, almost 1.3 million policies now, and we have to be at a higher standard. So, you know, do I like it? No. Do I think it was unfair? I think there were some mischaracterizations sometimes, but that's the media's job is to report on these things. We shouldn't be doing anything that we're concerned will end up in the media.
So maybe she actually thought it was being treated fairly. But Paola, you do a significant amount of reporting, or at least know about the Citizens issue. And first on the broader issue of people being priced out of insurance. Just I'm one of them that
totally
got moved
agree.
Out. I mean, that people are getting their bills now and are just the sticker shock is killing them. It's unbelievable.
You know, it's making homeownership unaffordable to the struggling middle class. And again, this is going to create a society of classes. The one who can afford to not only buy a home, but maintain a home, which means paying for insurance and property taxes, and the people who are doomed to renting for the rest of their lives. So, you know, no, I'm totally against increasing these fees, especially an agency that, you know, has some transparency issues to deal with, to overcome.
Right. So, I mean, they're raising their rates now. We asked members, and there's this new plan now from Tallahassee, which is going to, which may squeeze all private insurers. And I'm one of those that got moved off of Citizens and onto private insurance, and now I'm waiting to find out what my next bill will be. They told me yesterday, when I spoke to the Christine Ashburn, that they're not capitalized enough for this 1-in-100-year storm. But I can't help believe it. You just look at this, Glenn, as just sort of a shell game that's going on here that I don't understand, that even the smartest people don't understand how actuarial risk and all this stuff works.
Well, I agree with you. People don't understand, but I think perhaps not in the same way you think. First of all, on Citizens, there are two separate issues. Obviously, the party boy aspect of Citizens and the severance for sexual harassers, that's all wrong. It should be cracked down upon. People should be horsewhipped. I'm totally in favor of that. Hiking prices and reducing coverage is completely separate from that issue.
Should a company that's doing that be doing that?
They should be hiking prices, period.
A state-run company, by the way.
Yes. Because you should not have a taxpayer-funded institution undercutting the private sector on this. What that is doing is running private insurance out of Florida, and that's going to hurt us all. You don't get lower prices by reducing competition. We need more insurance companies competing for business in Florida, and the fact that insurance companies are trying to leave Florida instead of increase their business here should tell us something. This is not happening in the rest of the United States.
We asked members of the Public Insight Network for their thoughts, and let's just hear this sample of voicemail.
My name is Dr. Jonathan Rose. We obviously have a critical crisis with the insurance for homes and wind. Why not then subsidize this coverage for anybody who has a homestead exemption? In lieu of subsidizing football teams, baseball teams, why not take taxpayer money and subsidize the cost of this outrageously high insurance, which is forcing people to leave and which will diminish the capacity of our own communities?
So, Paula, what do you think of that? It's kind of the point that was made earlier about education, but why don't we take that 1% hotel tax and help the homeowners?
You know, that is a thought. That's something that
maybe
worth.
But it's
maybe,
not something that legally could be done, right?
I mean, yeah, you know.
Well, I also think, listen, you know, I've made it pretty clear I'm against subsidies for sports teams. But honestly, you are not going to achieve much of a subsidy for insurance by turning over the money that the Dolphins are asking for. These are vast sums. And insurance companies are not making money here. What people don't understand is with the insurance business, even more than most businesses, you have to look at it in a long-term picture and not the year-to-year picture. Yeah, profits are big 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, but profits are disastrously non-existent when you have a hurricane. So between 2000 and 2009, insurance companies in Florida had a 0.5% rate of return for investors. That compares to 4.7% in the rest of the United States. You can see why insurance companies are kind of not thinking Florida is a good place to do business anymore.
But, you know, okay, but I'm paying so much. Well, we're not going to get too far into this, but I think we all are paying property or insurance rates that are a lot higher than other people pay in other parts of the country. Other people may pay higher taxes. But doesn't that indicate, and we haven't had a storm in 8 years, doesn't indicate that they are, how could they not be capitalized?
We've had over 100 hurricanes hit Florida since records started being kept in 1850. This is the most hurricane-prone part of the country. And yeah, we're going to have to pay for the insurance for that. You should check out the price for earthquake insurance in California. It's astronomical. Most people don't have it because they can't afford it. It's because they have earthquakes in California. There's no free ride here. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
But what is scary about the bill that is you know going to go, the citizen property insurance, is that it changes a legal mandate that insurance in Florida be affordable. They're going to be changing, or the proposed new language would be prices should reflect the risk covered. So, meaning, I assume, property built closer to the water will be a lot more expensive. And again, so that means the middle class won't be able to afford to live closer to the water. So, that's my issue with it.
And I know a lot of people are thinking about paying off their houses, taking their savings out, paying off their houses so that they can avoid paying the citizens' bill, having to be bound by their mortgage company to actually have that type of insurance, because they're just unbelievable bills that are coming in. Anyway, so that's something we'll table, and that's something that we're also talking about at the town hall meeting. There's the plug, February 25th, Monday at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. We're going to have a couple of lawmakers. You can ask them all about citizens. We expect to hear some angry homeowners that are going to be showing up for that.
Nice segue.
Now, I wanted to, speaking of angry, today, well, I have to ask the most important story, Mr. Corbin, that we need to ask you about before we move on to some other stuff, but is the botched investigation into the University of Miami's booster scandal. We're waiting for a decision here. But the NCAA is now investigating itself, and this is something we have not talked about a lot on this show. We've mentioned it, but what exactly is going on, and what are the consequences of this?
Well, finally, the NCAA has found a worthy target. Its own investigative division and people responsible for looking into what they call college football scandals, which are actually kids getting a dinner from a booster or going on a booster's boat. Very trivial things, as we've seen Ohio State tattoos, for example, valued at $75 that are against the rules. In fact, in some cases, you have student tutors who lend a pen to a student athlete that can be misconstrued as a benefit. And what we have now is the shocking discovery that the NCAA at the highest levels, a vice president and I believe, general counsel, someone in the general counsel's office of the NCAA, approved five-figure payments, upwards of $25,000, to Maria Elena Perez to essentially subsidize...
That's Nevin Shapiro's attorney.
Yes, to subsidize the legal expenses of Nevin Shapiro, a confessed Ponzi schemer, in their effort to get the University of Miami football program. And what they actually did was exploit the federal deposition process so that they could have subpoena power over witnesses to question them, not about the federal case against Nevin Shapiro, the bankruptcy proceeding, but rather about NCAA violations of the University of Miami football program.
So quickly, does that mean that the sanctions against UM will be lessened because they screwed up on their own?
I think to save face, it would behoove them to do that, but you also have to remember the University of Miami has self-imposed significantly over the last 2 years.
Right, they've canceled two bowl games. All right, and one final thing, you have to talk about this bizarre story of a South Plantation high school star, and I actually went to go cover him this year in a story I did for NPR, Alex Collins, but it was about the girl quarterback, Erin DiMeglio, but all of a sudden this kid is embroiled in this huge controversy in his family over where to go, and he chooses Arkansas. Just to summarize that.
Well, Randy Shannon actually recruited him, the former head coach of the University of Miami, much to the chagrin of a lot of Hurricanes fans down here. And he's 18 years old and essentially gets to choose his own path, also much to his mother's chagrin, who I understand is hiring a lawyer because she doesn't want her son to leave the state. His father approved that decision, I think co-signed his letter of intent, or as we call it, the voluntary relinquishment of one's rights on National Signing Day. A voluntary letter that people still sign for some unknown reason to me. But it just figures, I think Dave Lamont said it best, that the biggest scandal out of National Signing Day comes out of Florida.
And I guess, well, why would that be any different?
Am I the only one who was surprised to learn that a parent has to sign off on this? No parent signed off for me when I went off to college.
The reason is that most student athletes are too young to be contractually obligated under the agreement, so they require that across
18.
The board. So that, right, even despite the fact that he's already 18, they just make that a blank requirement.
So you, speaking of this, you've got Broke, which I know just was on ESPN the other day, your
yes.
latest documentary. What else are you working on quickly there?
Right now, coming up next is Dogfight, DAWG, about the underground, unsanctioned world of backyard fighting in Perrine.
And Glenn, what are you working on TV-wise?
I'm preparing to attack Billy's film
when
it airs on television.
Paola, what about you? What do you got planned?
I continue to cover the foreclosure world.
And doing it well. Paola Uspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review, Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald, and Billy Corbin from Rakentor Films. I don't know why I like to say it that way. It sounds Russian. But anyway, nice to have you all here.
Thank you.
That does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, February the 8th, 2013. If you missed any of the show, we do rebroadcast it. And in fact, it is available on our fine website, WLRN.org. It will be broadcasted again if you're up early tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., where you can download the podcast as always. Florida Roundup is produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Elaine Chen, our associate producer. And thank you, Elaine, again this week. Our public insight analyst is Steph Farrow, social media editor Danny Rivero. For executive producer for WLRN, Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, it's Dan Gretsch. Thanks also to our fine technical supervisor, Paul Fingers Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman. Stay informed, South Florida, and thanks for listening.